For years, stress and or depression have been suspected of somehow increasing the risk of contracting numerous infectious diseases. In addition, there's mounting statistical evidence that increased levels of stress and depression also correlate with an increased incidence of cancer. And finally, there's strong statistical evidence linking stress and depression with death itself. Now there's even a new field of research called psychoneuroimmunology that is dedicated to unlocking the connection between our thoughts, that is our nervous systems, and our immune systems. Researchers have discovered several links between our thoughts and our immune systems. For one, we know that when we're stressed, our bodies produce more adrenaline. And while it's true that adrenaline helps to mobilize the body's energy reserves, it's also true that adrenaline causes a decrease in available antibodies and reduction in both the number and strength of lymphocytes. We've also learned that the brain is directly wired to the organs of the immune system, the spleen, thymus, lymph nodes, and bone marrow, and that stress and depression affect their performance. But most interesting of all is the connection between the neuropeptides produced by brain cells and the rest of the body. In much the same way that the immune system uses the interleukins to communicate with itself, the brain uses the hormone-like neuropeptides to communicate with itself and the rest of the body, including the immune system. The cells of the immune system carry receptors for the various neuropeptides produced by the brain. When we're happy, for example, the brain produces one kind of neuropeptide. The cells of the immune system have specific receptors for these up chemicals. Once received, these neuropeptides literally cause the immune system to strengthen and build. Correspondingly, when we're depressed, we produce a different set of neuropeptides. Immune cells also have receptors for these down communicators, whose net effect on the immune system is to shut it down. Incidentally, this is by no means a one-way communication. The cells of the brain have receptor sites for the interleukins and interferon produced by the lymphocytes of the immune system. Even better, it turns out that some macrophages and activated lymphocytes actually are capable of producing their own neuropeptides to communicate directly with the brain in its own language, as it were. That's stunning. Basically, through the same two systems, the nervous system and the circulatory system that our minds interact with our immune systems, our minds also connect with every organ and cell in our bodies, affecting the performance, functioning, growth, etc. of our immune systems, bones, bone marrow, glands, hearts, everything from heart rate to the heart tissue itself, the walls of our veins and arteries, the functioning of individual cells in the body, and even, as we'll see, the very structure of our DNA. At this point, it's probably worth focusing a bit on what stress and depression actually are. Stress is our body's response to all of the demands made upon it. Your body responds to all stresses, both positive and negative, by trying to get back to normal. 43% of all adults suffer adverse health effects due to stress. 75 to 90% of all visits to primary care physicians are for stress-related complaints or disorders. When a stressor is perceived, the hypothalamus triggers your adrenal glands to release corticosteroids to increase metabolism to provide an immediate increase in energy. Simultaneously, your pituitary releases a hormone called ACTH, or ACTH, which causes your adrenal glands to release epinephrine and norepinephrine, which work to prolong your body's fight or flight response. If a stressful situation goes on for too long without any relief, you may feel tired, or irritable, depressed, or anxious. You may have trouble sleeping or eating. You might experience diseases and disorders such as headaches, insomnia, high blood pressure, and cardiovascular and kidney diseases, colds, ulcers, asthma, heart attack, and a stroke. Stress has been linked to all the leading causes of death, including heart disease, cancer, lung ailments, accidents, cirrhosis, and suicide. Stress is said to be responsible for more than half of the 550 million workdays lost annually because of absenteeism. Eventually, your body's energy reserves are exhausted. It breaks down. Recent research has confirmed the role of stress in cardiovascular disease, in cancer, gastrointestinal disease, skin, neurological and emotional disorders, and a host of disorders linked to immune system disturbances, ranging from the common cold and herpes to arthritis, cancer, and AIDS. Now, depression, on the other hand, works in your body in different ways than stress, but the results are the same. As we've already discussed, neuropeptides can either jack up your immune system or shut it down, depending on your thoughts. In effect, negative thoughts can actually kill you. An example, a group of medical researchers in Montreal tracked 222 post-heart attack victims, both men and women. The researchers found that those who were depressed, who felt sad, hopeless, and listless, were more likely to die of another heart attack within 18 months of their first heart attack than those who were not. 10 times more likely, in fact. In other words, as Dr. John Christopher used to say, Most people need an enema between the ears. The bottom line is that the entire body is literally created and run by the brain, with equal input back from the organs and cells themselves. Again, through both the direct wired connection of the nervous system and the neuropeptides traveling through the circulatory system. The net result is that in addition to what medical researchers have been able to verify and explain, there are a number of incidents that hint at so much more. A strong correlation has been established between depression and heart attacks. Several examples include, the January 95 issue of the American Journal of Medicine reported on a study of patients with a history of heart disease that found that those who were depressed were 8 times more likely to develop potentially deadly heart rhythms than those who were not depressed. A 10-year study was conducted to follow the mortality rates of people who had experienced stroke. Those who had been diagnosed with either major or minor depression were 3.4 times as likely to have died within the follow-up period. The death rate among depressed patients with few social contacts was especially high, over 90%. Or in a study of 194 heart attack patients, those who reported lower amounts of emotional support were nearly 3 times more likely to die within 6 months than those with higher levels of emotional support. Here's another fascinating connection between the mind and the body. Have you ever wondered when most people die? Statistically, it turns out that people are more likely to die on Monday morning before going to work than at any other time in the week. There's been much speculation as to why this happens, but in general, most people agree it's something along the lines of most people have heart attacks on Monday morning because they're stressed that they're heading back to jobs that they can't stand after a weekend off. Then again, we need to mention placebos. That's sugar pills that are administered to patients who think they're potent medicine. On average, as many as 35% of all people who receive a given placebo experience a significant effect. And here's something you may not know. For years, it's been suspected by many doctors and poo-pooed by many more that patients under anesthesia can hear their surgeon's comments and that what they hear affects them. There were many anecdotal stories of doctors who, upon opening a patient up, would see a tumor and comment out loud that it looked malignant, and then, even though the tumor would later prove to be non-malignant, the patient nevertheless would fade rapidly and be dead in a matter of days. Well, new studies are now proving that not only is this true, but to a degree far higher than previously imagined. Dr. Henry Bennett, a psychologist from the University of California Medical School at Davis, suggests that under anesthesia, patients might be especially vulnerable to upsetting remarks they overhear since their normal coping techniques aren't available to them. Specifically, the studies that support this statement include a number of patients were given the suggestion during surgery that one of their hands was becoming warmer and the other cooler. The temperature of both hands changed accordingly. In another study, patients were played a tape message while they were anesthetized during surgery that told them that if they heard the same message later, they should signify that they heard it by touching their ears in a postoperative interview. Later in the interview, all of the patients absentmindedly tugged at their ears, although not one of the patients could recall having heard the message. During back surgery, which normally causes urination problems for patients after surgery, researchers suggested to the anesthetized patients that they would be able to relax their pelvic muscles after the surgery and thus would need no catheter. None of the patients who received the suggestion subsequently needed a catheter. The story gets even more remarkable as we look at the connection between our DNA and our minds. In 1952, the British Medical Journal reported on an extraordinary case concerning Brock's disease, a genetic disorder that causes the skin to resemble the scales of a reptile. Many so-called alligator people in circus sideshows are victims of Brock's disease. Anyway, what was so extraordinary about this case is that although Brock's disease is an hereditary genetic condition and considered incurable by the medical community, it was nevertheless cured in this particular case through hypnosis. To put it simply, under hypnosis, the patient, a 16-year-old boy, was able to go into his body and literally reprogram his DNA. The net result is that within 10 days of starting treatment, the boy was symptom-free and remained so for at least 5 years, at which point his therapist lost touch with him. And there's probably the best-known example of all, as was reported by Dr. Bruno Klopfer in the Journal of Projective Techniques back in 1957. A patient of Dr. Klopfer's, whose cancer had metastasized and whose body was riddled with tumors, had reached the point where all available medical approaches had failed, and he was confined to bed with only a few days to live. Then, just before the end, the patient heard about crebiazin, an experimental drug then being tested. Desperate, he demanded that his doctors include him in the experimental trials. Believing that the man was as good as dead anyway and that they therefore had nothing to lose, they put him on crebiazin. Miraculously, the man's tumors began to melt away. He made a remarkable recovery and was discharged from the hospital. 2 months later, however, reports began to appear that continuing research on crebiazin had raised serious doubts about the efficacy of the drug. Within a few days of the patient's reading these reports, his tumors had returned and he was once again on the verge of terminal. At this point, his doctor did something unusual in the medical profession. He lied to his patient. He told the man that they now had available a newer, more potent version of crebiazin. He then proceeded to inject the man, not with a new and improved version of crebiazin, not even with the original version, but with plain old water. Astoundingly, the man's tumors once again began to melt away. As before, the man made a remarkable recovery and went home. He then remained perfectly healthy in full remission for 7 whole months until he saw a news report that declared nationwide AMA tests show crebiazin to be worthless as a cancer treatment. 2 days later, he was dead. Okay, so we're pretty clear now on the connection between the mind and the body. The big question is, what can you do about it? Well, the major pharmaceutical companies, as usual, have developed a set of drugs called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, to manage the symptoms associated with stress and depression. You might know them as prescription drugs Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Lovix, and Celexa. Don't you just love those names? Anyway, thanks to millions and millions of dollars in promotion, some misguided books that jumped on the bandwagon, and our own marvelous tendency to believe in magic bullets, we have become a Prozac nation, but not without cost. SSRIs cause mania and delusions of grandeur in 1 out of every 25 children taking the drugs. A tendency to violence has been reported in 1 out of 16 Prozac users. In 70% of all murder-suicides involving women and their children, the women were on SSRIs. And then there's the Columbine High School tragedy. Specialized testing during the autopsy of Eric Harris, one of the Columbine shooters, showed therapeutic levels of a particular brand of SSRI in his blood. In addition, he was also taking cough syrup. The interaction between cough medications containing dextromethorphan, found in things like Robitussin, for example, and SSRIs can greatly increase the possibility of a toxic reaction known as serotonin syndrome, leading to PCP-like reactions. In effect, Eric Harris was unknowingly on the equivalent of angel dust. That explains a lot, don't you think? Kip Kinkle, who shot his parents and then shot his classmates in Oregon, was on SSRIs. Bryn Hartman, the actor Phil Hartman's wife, was on an SSRI when she shot her husband and committed suicide. In March of 1998, Matthew Beck went on a bloody rampage at his office, the Kinetic Lottery Corporation headquarters, killing 4 senior lottery officials before committing suicide. He was on 2 antidepressants, including the same one Eric Harris was on. Many children under the age of 3 have already been given Prozac by their pediatrician, and soon a special flavored version will be available just for children. Also, since I'm on the subject, I should probably mention something about Ritalin. Did you know that in the United States today we use 5 times more Ritalin than the rest of the world combined? Or did you know that when Ritalin is injected into cocaine addicts, they can't tell the difference between Ritalin and cocaine? Or did you know that children on Ritalin are 300% more likely to become addicted to alcohol and drugs later in life? And we're passing this out to our children like candy. And all this for something that in over 90% of cases can be eliminated by a change in diet and the removal of food additives from the diet. Someone, please protect us from ourselves. Anyway, getting back to stress and depression. For the vast majority of people bothered by stress or depression, there is a safe, effective solution. A well-designed herbal formula made from high-quality herbs and that makes use of the complementary synergies inherent in many herbs can prove remarkably effective. Look for an herbal formula that contains herbs such as valerian root. For centuries, valerian has been used to treat nervous tension and panic attacks. It's a wonderful herb. Valerian is calming and quieting to the nervous system. Kava kava is the herb of choice to relax the body, relieve stress, to combat mild to moderate anxiety, for relief from headache and back pain. Kava is now recognized by many doctors as an alternative to drugs like Xanax and Valium. Lobelia is an extremely powerful antispasmodic and sedative. It helps improve breathing dramatically by dilating the bronchial tubes. It's great for asthmatics. Passion flower is remarkably effective as a sedative to calm nerves to get on edge. St. John's wort, sometimes called nature's Prozac, helps relieve stress, anxiety, and tension. In Germany, it's the most popular antidepressant, outselling Prozac 3-1. And then there's black cohosh. First used by the American Indians, black cohosh works to soothe the body by reducing the rapidity of the pulse. Black cohosh also works internally to help soothe any nervous diseases or spasms. And finally, there's skullcap, hops, and catnip, 3 herbs that have a long history as marvelously effective herbal tranquilizers, sedatives, and sleep aids. Anyway, casting aside the extreme point of view that all illness originates in the mind, as in, Harriet, why are you choosing to give yourself breast cancer? We are nonetheless left with the fact that what we think and how we think does absolutely and unequivocally affect our health. The bottom line is if you want to make your mind your partner in health, you need to work at it. It takes work to move your mind out of stress and depression. Here are four exercises to help you in the process. First, learn to meditate. If nothing else, just try watching your breath. Sit down, keep your back straight, close your eyes, and watch your breath. Watch as your breath goes in and your lungs fill. Watch as it goes out and your lungs empty. Don't force your breath, just watch it. It's unbelievably relaxing. Number two, learn to visualize. After you've meditated on your breath for a few minutes and calmed down, practice a visualization. See your body as being made of healing light. Imagine the light penetrating and healing every cell in your body. If you're sick, focus the light on the diseased area. Then, practice affirmation. What we say matters. We all know, for example, someone who uses the word afraid all the time, as in, I'm afraid I won't be able to go tonight. I'm afraid I've eaten too much. I'm absolutely stuffed. I'm afraid I'm almost out of gas, etc. Is it any wonder that eventually these people are afraid all the time? And then there are the examples that Dr. Bernie Siegel includes in his book Love, Medicine, and Miracles, such as the man who said he was always considered spineless and in the end developed multiple myeloma in his backbone to support his contention. Or the woman who had a mastectomy who told Dr. Siegel that she needed to get something off her chest. The bottom line is that instead of being controlled by the things we say, instead of having your health compromised by idle words, we should put words to work for us. Try repeating to yourself over and over with each step you take when walking or while you're driving something like, I'm joy, I'm peace, I'm health, I'm light, or make up your own. If so, make it short and rhythmical so it says itself to a walking cadence. It really does work magic. I once hiked the full length of the John Muir Trail, about 237 miles, silently reciting a similar affirmation every single step of the way. By the end of the trip, I repeated the affirmation something over 500,000 times, and I was sailing up and down over 10,000-foot passes and up and down the 15,000 feet of Mount Whitney. And the last suggestion is take an herbal break. Use an herbal nerve tonic formulation that contains the herbs that we talked about before, valerian root, kava kava, passion flower, hops, black cohosh, St. John's wort, and lobelia. It'll help you remember what the word mellow really means. And that's it for part 13 of the Take Back Your Health series. In part 14, we're going to talk about exercise. It really is a question of move or die.